RN, your daily commute companion.
And a very good morning to you, Natasha Mitchell, joining you for Life Matters here on ABC RN for the next hour of your day. The Fox and the Freedom Fighters. The Fox, an Indigenous leader who blazed a trail, living a very public life on the public stage over many decades. Well, now his daughter and granddaughter have reprised his story to tell it through their eyes on a theatre stage. It's a very moving and intimate portrayal of the private face of a public life, a rare glimpse, I think, and a very frank one. Rhonda Grosvenor, Dixon Grosvenor and Nardina Dixon join us. And also on the show, the upside of down. Susan Bigger's extraordinary story of the power of family and the drive to create one. That's coming up. Omega-3 fatty acids are the supplement for our times, it seems, because of their role in brain health and function. Parents give omega-3 tablets to their kids. Adults are taking them in the hope of staving off cognitive decline. But can omega-3 play a role in staving off a much more serious psychiatric problem, schizophrenia? Might it have a preventative role in young people who are at risk of psychosis, perhaps through early heavy marijuana use, for example, or family trauma, or indeed genetics? Now, that's the suggestion, according to intriguing work being presented at the International Early Psychosis Conference, which is underway in Tokyo this week. Australian researchers are there. In fact, you might know, led by the early work of former Australian of the Year Patrick McGorry and his colleagues, Australia is recognised as the leader in early psychosis intervention and prevention. Professor Paul Aminger from Origin Youth Health Research Centre in Melbourne joined me on the line a little earlier from Tokyo.
Hello, Natasha.
The work you and Patrick McGorry are presenting at the conference builds on research that you published a couple of years ago that got a lot of attention. What made you think, though, that omega-3 might play a biological role in early psychosis or psychotic thoughts in young people?
There are epidemiological findings which showed, for instance, that fish consumption correlates with the rate of mental disorders. For instance, depression is higher and more prevalent in countries with lower fish consumption, but also bipolar disorder, another severe psychiatric disorder, and psychosis seem to be associated with the rate of fish consumption. And another basic research finding is, which goes back maybe a couple of decades, that people with schizophrenia actually have lower cell membrane levels of omega-3 fatty acids.
It's very interesting, isn't it? What would those lower levels indicate in terms of what we see behaviourally when people have a psychotic episode? Those delusions, those hallucinations, that chaotic thinking.
What's most important to keep in mind is that cell membranes are very important for neurotransmission as well as all cell functions. And low levels of omega-3 fatty acids may be caused by oxidative stress, one mechanism which is likely to contribute to the onset of psychosis. But also a very important mechanism of omega-3 fatty acids is that they are anti-inflammatory. And inflammation seems to be a key player for physical conditions, but also more recently people became aware that depression and schizophrenia is associated with an increase in inflammatory cytokines. And omega-3 fatty acids are anti-inflammatory.
Yes, those cytokines being those key immune system cells that really indicate that inflammation is occurring. This is right at the cutting edge of our understanding in psychiatry, and it's also a reminder how little we understand how psychosis works in the brain, in the body, how schizophrenia works. But this idea, Paul, of preventing psychosis in teenagers before any key signs of psychosis appear particularly using antipsychotic medications to do that. That's been very controversial, hasn't it? And with good reason, because these are very heavy medications. Has this been part of your interest in looking for more of a dietary supplement approach to preventing psychosis in kids?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And antipsychotics, unfortunately, have side effects. Those side effects include weight gain, but also we need to be aware that those medications are usually necessary for decades. It's not a quick decision, and after a few weeks, you can move on. You have those side effects for a longer period.
Mm-hmm.
You're also right that the whole idea to intervene early is controversial because our medications and our tools are not benign enough. And therefore, researchers started to look at other potential candidates. And one of those candidates are omega-3 fatty acids, but there are also others like amino acids, like N-acetylcysteine, or anti-inflammatory compounds like aspirin. They get some attention too.
Mm.
But omega-3 seemed to us like an ideal candidate because it's generally health beneficial and has no stigma attached to it. And therefore, we decided to do this first trial in 2010. And we were surprised because the effect sizes, what we saw, were actually stronger than those who have been reported in trials using low doses of antipsychotics.
Well, let's go back to that study because you've been building on that, and that's the work you're going to present this week at the International Early Psychosis Conference there in Tokyo. That 2010 study took a cohort, a group of 13 to 25-year-olds, 81 of them. This is also controversial, this notion that you can take a group of young people who aren't psychotic yet, but demonstrate what you describe as being ultra high risk of psychosis. What were they demonstrating to you that might suggest that?
I think it's very important to be aware that psychosis doesn't start from one moment to the other. It's more a development over days, quite often over months, and for some people even years. And the great work of Patrick McGorry and his colleagues, they have established a system to classify people with attenuated forms of psychotic symptoms. They think some people probably try to harm them or try to influence their thoughts, but they are not delusional and they're not convinced about this.
We're talking about kids, though, aren't we? We're talking about a 13-year-old, for example. What signs, what behaviours, what thinking patterns are you using as an indicator of concern?
For instance, they hear sounds or even voices and no one is in the room and they find this strange. Some of them find that other people probably try to do them any harm. They start to behaviorally react to that, withdraw. Those are all symptoms which impact on your functioning already at an early stage. So those young people who are not psychotic yet, they already have functional decline. They have problems at school. They have problems with their peers.
Mm.
That's why it is important at this early stage to intervene to prevent this functional decline, which very often manifests before the onset of the full threshold symptom.
His parents, Paul Eminger, will be listening to this conversation with acute interest, I think, and concern, no doubt, about their children and what they might be observing in their children. When you did this study a couple of years ago of giving this group of young people, 13 to 25, omega-3 supplements, did you design it so that it was properly controlled for, so that you knew it was omega-3 supplements that you were seeing the results of? So was it a double-blinded, placebo-controlled trial?
Yeah, that's right. So it is a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, and we actually masked the placebo with 1% of fish oil, so it tasted and smelled similar.
Fishy.
And yes, that's right. Because the first thing people were doing were just chewing the capsules to find out in what group they might be.
Smart
in.
Kids.
So we carefully tried to mask the interventions, and we still maintained the double blind until the longer term follow-up.
So you didn't know who was getting what either?
No.
And what did you find? Because this is very striking. And so what you're presenting this week is a kind of longer term trial that you've been tracking a group of these young people over 7 years now. But what did you find then that was so striking?
The key finding at 12 months was that around 4% in the omega-3 group and 28% in the placebo group made a transition to a psychotic disorder. That's highly significant. At the longer-term follow-up, we were now establishing if this was just a delay or if we have actually prevented the onset of psychosis in this cohort. And what we saw while maintaining the double blind was that in the placebo group, the rate was now 40%, and in the omega-3 group, it was around 9%. So there were more progressions to psychosis, but the difference between the two groups actually widened.
And this is over what period of time?
7 years.
Do you know that definitely it's omega-3, the supplementation at work here? I mean, people eat omega-3 in their diets. All sorts of things change. Have you controlled for all the sorts of things that could be preventing someone from going on to experience psychosis?
Of course, it's very difficult to control all factors, but I think what's important to mention in Europe and specifically in Austria, where the study was conducted, omega-3 supplements are not as widely available as they are in Australia, first of all. What we have also done at baseline, we assessed fatty acids in red blood cell membranes. And those assessments actually showed that those kids had quite low levels of omega-3 fatty acids in their cell membranes, around 4%, and which is considered a risk for heart problems in cardiovascular disease in adults. And what we did after the intervention, which was only for 3 months, we reassessed and we saw that the levels actually tripled in the omega-3 group and they remained steady in the placebo group.
So they were soaking up that omega-3, you think. You have to replicate these findings still, and they are in the review process for publication. But what do you want young people and their parents to hear from these findings about the role of omega-3 supplementation if their kids are at high risk of psychosis, according to the signs that you've discussed?
I think it's very important for families and for young people to know that there might be treatments available soon which are far more benign and less stigmatizing than conventional psychiatric medications. And you're right, we have completed now a larger replication study in over 300 people, and those findings will be available early next year. But we've also started a new large trial in young people with depression, because antidepressants are actually only moderately effective in young people, and they probably have a higher risk of causing suicidal ideation in young people compared to adults. And many young people, they are not willing to take medications.
Understandably, so, it's a big decision for a young person to make.
That's right.
So that's a very interesting trial that you're undertaking. And I wonder, Paul Amager, that traditionally psychiatry has paid very little attention to the relationship between diet and mental health. This represents a real shift here in some sense, doesn't it? Because you're actually just talking about the sorts of doses and the sorts of pills. Obviously, you had to control for the type of omega-3 that we would be buying over the counter.
That's correct. Also, the quality of those supplements may vary, and I think it's also important to have probably more quality control in those products.
Yeah. How do you think your psychiatric colleagues might respond to this work? Because it's a big shift for them in their thinking in terms of, well, do we use an antipsychotic or do I give them fish oil?
When we started the study in Vienna, basically our colleagues were laughing at us. But I think a randomized controlled trial is the hardest evidence you can present. And of course, replication is important. So many of those colleagues probably take this whole area now more serious. Most of the discussions are positive. There's hardly anyone who says we shouldn't pursue this path further. So I think there's merit to really look at the efficacy in other diagnostic groups like depression as well, because the medications are not working so well. Antipsychotics are probably very effective in the short term, but no one has been able to show that they prevent anything over a longer period. And antidepressants are not as effective as one might wish.
No, they're not. No. What about those listening who have schizophrenia already, who are adults and well progressed in their illness? Does this send a message to them, these results?
Yes. I think the first studies that used omega-3 fatty acids was in people with schizophrenia who didn't respond well to their medications. So they had an add-on of omega-3 supplements. And there are trials which showed that they actually benefited from omega-3 fatty acids.
Yes.
But another important thing that should be mentioned is the side effects of antipsychotics. For instance, they increased triglycerides, and omega-3 fatty acids are a treatment to lower triglycerides. So the side effects of medications people with schizophrenia have to take, unfortunately, they are...
They might be ameliorated by omega-3s.
Exactly.
Well, it's very interesting work indeed, and of course there are lots of claims made about omega-3. Some of them are a little bit extreme, and so it's good to hear that you're doing such well-designed work. Good luck with presenting it in Tokyo this week, and thanks for joining us on Skype.
Thank you so much.
Paul Amager there, Professorial Research Fellow at Origin Youth Health Research Centre at the University of Melbourne, and more information about their work. Such interesting work, isn't it, on the Life Matters page, abc.net.au/rn. Well, look, up next, the Fox and the Freedom Fighters here on ABC RN.
Coming up on the Law Report, the fascinating dance between lawyers and documentary filmmakers. Lawyers want exposure for their clients and their cause, but they don't want to reveal strategy.
When they are tailoring their arguments to our Supreme Court justices, they don't want that footage saying, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to fall for this argument, or Clarence Thomas is not. And so we were always asked to leave a courtroom whenever they were talking about judges, which was disappointing.
That's on the Law Report with me, Damien Carrick, this afternoon at 5:30.
Well, now to a family story of fame and acclaim, but also about the toll that takes. And a warning for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, this conversation is about and names a man who is no longer alive. The late Charles or Chicka Dixon was a prominent Aboriginal leader and activist right back to the 1950s. And a new play, The Fox and the Freedom Fighters, on at the Performance Space in Sydney until Saturday, has been written in his memory. What makes this two-woman show especially unique, though, is it's penned and performed by his daughter and his granddaughter.
Mr. Chicka Dixon, a Sydney watersider. He returned 2 weeks ago with five other Aborigines after visiting China at the invitation of the Chinese.
You mean pay your compensation for loss of land?
For robbery. None of it's been paid for, so it must have been stolen. The white man came with the gun. And he took the land. Pay us for our land. Pay us what is morally our right.
Now, what's in here? 40 years ago, ASIO were investigating the Fox for alleged communist connections. And yet here we are in 2010. You give him a state funeral. Folks, as I would expect, Fox, you've had the last laugh.
Aboriginal activist Gary Foley there at the state funeral of Chicka Dixon back in 2010. Chicka Dixon's contemporaries in the Aboriginal civil rights movement included Charles Perkins, Mum Shirl. He was involved in the Federal Council for the Advancement of Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders from the 60s. He was a key campaigner for the Yes Vote in 1967, that referendum. And one of the founders of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy in 1972, so many roles. He also was the first Aboriginal person to be appointed as a councillor on the Australian Council and also chaired the council's Aboriginal Arts Board. Now, this play stars his daughter and his granddaughter, and joining us this morning, performer and educator Rhonda Dixon Grosvenor. Welcome, Rhonda.
Thank you.
His daughter and his granddaughter, Nadina Dixon, artist, singer, songwriter. Welcome.
Good morning.
Why did you want to write this story down now, this warts and all story, Rhonda?
Absolutely. Well, after Dad passed away in 2010 and he did receive a state funeral, he was acknowledged for his work, you know, that he did with social justice, human rights issues for Aboriginal people. And I thought, well, I'll talk with my daughter, and it's such an amazing story and such an important story that it's not just an Aboriginal story, it's an Australian story, and it's a story for the world to hear.
Mm.
Because Dad did travel all over the world, South Africa, Rome, Hawaii, America, with the Native American people.
China?
China.
That famous delegation, yes, in the 1970s, the Chinese invited an, yes, Indigenous delegation.
That's right, a personal invite by Chairman Mao. And at the time, the Iron Curtain was up, so no one was allowed in it in 72, around that time. But so he was personally invited by Chairman Mao, and he took an Aboriginal delegation over to China and was taken all, you know, escorted all around and to all the factories, the fields. He was the, had the barefoot doctors administer acupuncture, is it? Was it the little needles?
Yep.
And
he talked about that trip to you, did he?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. He said he spoke to 10,000 Chinese people in the Great Hall of China. Yeah, so it was absolutely amazing. And we had luckily that Dad was a person who kept all his, you know, photos, all his personal photos. And so in the factories, in the fields, outside Chairman Mao's home and so on. So we thought, well, here we've got all this material, what amazing material, that film and audio and photos.
Yes, but what makes this unusual, Nadina, is that at one point you go, we've been looking for the traces of him that we never got to experience. Because to a great degree, he was absent from your lives. He was so present on the public stage, but there was a deep absence there in your own personal lives.
Yeah, there were gaps. And through the process of the research, it really validated a lot of things to us, because we had a lot of family history that became part of our life. Like, we heard all the stories and we had all this sort of background information, but it was almost then like we were looking for the keys that would connect the parts of the knowledge that we had with the other parts that were missing. But in the play you'll see this element of weaving, and so that symbolically also represents the interwovenness of both of our lives, all of our lives, and that you really can't pull one thread out with all the other, without all the others being interconnected.
Yeah. There's a, early on, Alana Valentine, I think, who's co-written this, yes, with you, said to you, and what were you doing while Chika was changing the world?
Exactly.
And that was quite a confronting question, I get the sense. Why?
Absolutely. Well, it was quite a shock that Alana would ask that, because when we came at, you know, the beginning of this journey to put the play together, Nadina and I, it was all about Dad. We didn't have even think about telling our story, yeah, you know, and we're a bit, well, resistant to it, you know, because, well, we didn't really want to be up front, I guess, you know.
Well, let's probe a little further there, because there was a private face and a public face, and in fact, Rhonda, you grew up not so much with your dad. You grew up with your grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How different was that private and public face for you as his daughter, as Chika Dixon's daughter?
Well, when I was about in my teens, because my dad was an alcoholic when I was young. And I used to go out and see him at La Perouse, and he used to live in this little tin shack. So when he wasn't in the horrors and shaking or whatever, or in jail or in dry out, I got to see my dad, which wasn't very often. And so when he became sober and I was in my teens, that's when I was able to have more time with him. And I did get taken, and so did Nadina, to demonstrations and different, you know, talks about the Aboriginal justice and what's happening and that sort of thing. So,
did you feel close to his cause as a child, or did it feel remote?
Well, I knew of it, you know, I knew, but I didn't sort of grow up, you know, in that so much, like out there being actually in it, until I was a teenager, about 13. And then I was taken to the Tent Embassy, and so it was like, yeah, it was full on, you know, like from that time. It was exciting. You know, you're meeting all these, you go to the Tent Embassy and you've got people from all over Australia and the world and everything, you know, fire, campfires going, and people bringing in dampers and pots of chicken soup. And so it was exciting. There were interesting, so, you know, big interest in the Tent Embassy.
Almost two phases of his life, the kind of prehistory to his activism, which was, he, and you tell the story, he lost his first son, your brother,
yes,
in a tragic accident.
Yes.
Alcohol, metho, he turned to the meth.
That's right, yeah.
He ended up in Long Bay. But something pulled him out of that.
Exactly, yeah.
What do you think that was?
I personally just feel like that he had this mission to fulfil his purpose of why he came to this, you know, to this earth, that he had a purpose to fulfil, and it wasn't to die as an alcoholic. So I think once he connected with that purpose and sort of found his true spirit, then he could find that inner strength.
Nadina, you play, well, you play Rhonda's daughter in real life on,
yes,
stage, but there's also a really beautiful scene that represents one of your enduring memories of him coming back from sampling the Black Power movement in the US. And what does he bring back?
Oh, a black Barbie, of course.
Serious cred in the playground.
Well, yeah, well, she created a lot of problems in you know, just in my family as well, as I sort of play out in the theatre work, that we'd never seen a black doll. They had all these Aboriginal girls that had never seen a black doll. So I think there's a lot of layers of sort of meaning under that, and like who were we identifying with as young girls growing up, and that Australia at that time didn't have any black dolls on the market. So, yeah, it was a bit of a stir.
Joining me this morning on Life Matters are Nadina Dixon, artist, singer, songwriter and performer and educator Rhonda Dixon. They are related, mother and daughter. They are telling the story of their own lives, but also the story of their father and grandfather, Chika Dixon, a very eminent Indigenous leader who was a real trailblazer in the civil rights movement on behalf of Aboriginal people in Australia. And the play is called The Fox and the Freedom Fighters. There's a really moving scene, Nadina, in the play where both of you describe heading to the suburbs of Canberra to live in a red brick box. You hated that.
Yeah, I did. It was a real period of transition for Aboriginal people. After the end of the Protection Board policies, there was a whole period where we were pretty much able to go back to traditional life. And so I was growing up in that period, and then throughout the mid-70s there was a big push for us to be assimilated. So that was a real shock to the system for me.
Why was it a shock?
Because I'd been...
How old were you?
I must have been six or seven, and I actually went to school speaking Aboriginal language. We'd sort of developed a language mixing English and Aboriginal words, and I didn't know the difference. I went to school speaking language and then couldn't understand why none of the teachers would answer me.
And you felt like a freak kid.
I did, yeah.
Hanging with the other freak kids.
Yeah, I did.
Which isn't such a bad thing, we should point out. But for you, Rhonda, there was a sense that you'd done Dad proud, or that Dad... Your dad, Chika Dixon, would have approved of this, or did approve of this, this sort of, you know, living the dream,
yeah.
You know, jobs in the public service, owning your own home in Canberra. How did you feel about that phase of your life?
Well, I felt proud, you know, because my grandfather on my mother's side, he used to always talk about the Queen, and the big thing was getting one of the elders got a blanket from the Queen, and that was a big thing. So when we as Aboriginal person were able to, you know, get our own home, grandfather was absolutely just over the moon, because that just didn't happen in those days, that Aboriginal people was be given the opportunity to buy their own home. And also because of, you know, Dad's fight for justice and rights for Aboriginal people in education and work, and here we were, my husband and I, with jobs in the public service. So, you know, it was like we'd made it in Dad's eyes, you know, and it was important.
It was a tough relationship though, wasn't it? Because you get this sense in the play that he was busy advocating for Aboriginal people, but he wasn't so busy advocating for his own family all the time. So you were experiencing domestic violence.
Yeah.
And in fact, you ended up losing your first husband to a heart attack.
Yeah.
So it's a very sad story that you tell. But Chika sort of said when you sought help from him, he said, suck it up.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, when you're taught better, you know better. You know how to be a dad and to be supportive. But Dad's father was in Kinchula, was a Kinchula boy, Jimmy Dixon.
Tough
and
life.
So there was a lot of violence and abuse in that. And I haven't looked into that, which I'm going to do after the play is finished, because that's going to be hard journey for me. But when I found out that Dad's father was in Kinchula, that was helpful for me to understand why Dad was not able to connect as a father and that sort of thing.
Mm. Mm. What's this process been like for both of you? I can't imagine what you've been through together as a mother and daughter in kind of reaping through this archive and then bringing it alive through your own life experience. Nadina?
It's been a very difficult process. It's also been a very healing process. And I think it really teaches about compassion, and not just compassion for what grandfather was trying to achieve, but what those circumstances does to a person's psyche as well.
Mm.
Because there is always a cost, and somehow you sort of exist in this unnatural setting, and you're trying to assert your own identity through all of that and make sense of it, and some of it doesn't make sense.
Rhonda, has it been tough at times?
Oh, yeah.
Were there fisticuffs? Were there tears?
Oh, yeah, of course. We're mother and daughter.
I need to explain. Nadina's eyes just rolled heavily in her eye sockets then, folks.
Well, you know, we're both adults and we're both strong Aboriginal women. I mean, we are my father's, you know, we've got the DNA in us, you know, so we're quite outspoken. And, a hard journey. Thank you, Alana.
But I think it's also, we would also fight the good fight for the integrity of the peace.
Mm.
And so every person brought that to the table.
Well, you've arrived, and the show continues at the Performance Space right through until Saturday. That's over in Sydney. Rhonda Dixon-Grosvenor and Nadina Dixon, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters. The show, The Fox, we didn't even get to his ASIO files, and The Freedom Fighters. And, let's play out now with a song from Nadina's CD, Butterfly.
Yes.
Let the music play on.
Let the storm clouds gather and the rainfall wear.
From the CD Butterfly, the song Let the Music Play On by singer-songwriter Nadina Dixon. And of course, Nadina and Rhonda joining us. Their show, The Fox and the Freedom Fighters, on at the Performance Space in Sydney. We'll pop some photos up on our Facebook page from the production. Look, our next story is a family story as well. And fraught and fabulous, all in the one rolled-up bag as well. It begins in a pair of sleeping bags on the North Island of New Zealand. A New Zealander and an American have fallen in love, gotten hitched, have discovered that they are expecting their first baby, the product of a transcontinental love. What to expect your first year is amongst their parenting books. And then the unexpected happens. What came next, and then again with baby number two, would throw most of us right off balance. Not for Globetrotters Susan Bigger and her husband Daryl, as I grappled with immense challenges and choices they've never stopped adventuring, as we'll hear. It's a story Susan tells in her new book, The Upside of Down. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good.
It does start in a pair of sleeping bags on the North Island, staying in a gliding club of all places. Your son, Aidan, comes knocking 7 weeks premature. Tell us what happened.
We were very unprepared, actually, probably more than 7 weeks unprepared. We were last-minuters, and so we didn't have anything, including a name or a bed. But emotionally, we weren't ready to have a baby, I think. And we certainly weren't ready to have a baby with health challenges. I think I just lived in a bubble, and I just didn't even... I wasn't one of those people who worried, so I didn't prepare myself for that. Some women worry so much during pregnancy, they think everything's going to go wrong, and I thought everything was going to go right.
And it was a rather crude way that you found out, actually, that Aidan had cystic fibrosis when he arrived in the world. What happened?
Look, it was, and I think it was really unfortunate, and I'm sure that the health team would have been very saddened by what happened, but they just accidentally, I guess, they left a letter out on his incubator, and I happened to come in and picked up the letter, and it said that he'd tested positive for something called cystic fibrosis in the heel prick test, which they did in New Zealand and they do in Australia. And I had no idea what it was. But it didn't sound like something we wanted, that was for sure.
So you didn't have a sense of the gravitas of that diagnosis and the prognosis that comes with it?
Look, I had no idea. I didn't even know, to be honest, whether it had to do with muscles or brain, or it turned out that cystic fibrosis is mostly about the lungs. It affects a number of organs, but most importantly, the lungs and infection. And it wasn't really until we, until the doctor said to me, oh, don't worry, I'm sure it's a false positive. And we went home that night and picked up the dictionary and started to look and thought, uh-oh. Oh, my God, yeah, we're in trouble, possibly.
What followed in the weeks and months to come?
Well, it was a
pretty
dark...
How did it become apparent? Because it is a very, very tough diagnosis, and there's much more to this story, as we'll hear.
Yeah. So we found out for sure about 2 weeks later that he would definitely had CF, and then I think it was like a... I don't know. It was like a curtain fell for me, and life really changed. And it just felt like a very, very dark period of a time when... in a way, you're meant to be so joyful because you've just had this brand new baby, and people would meet me on the street, and he looked, apart from being very, very skinny, he looked like a pretty normal-looking, lovely, skinny little baby. And so then there was always this thing, well, do I tell them that we've got this devastating thing we're living with? Or so that was, I remember, one of my early struggles was around... to reveal or not, to share or not, to put yourself out there, and so it was all new territory for me. And I think apart from tending to his needs, physical needs, and trying to be there reasonably as a mother and kind of keep my marriage alive, I feel like I spent a lot of time just sort of comatose in those first 6 months and adjusting to a really new world.
Remind us of what you had to adjust to, and remind us what cystic fibrosis means for a child and for their parents.
Yeah, well, so when he's young, I mean, even in a healthy person with cystic fibrosis, you wouldn't notice any difference. It's really what's going on in their body, and particularly in their lungs. They can have repeated infections or inflammation that lead to damage in the lungs. And so it's really about protecting the lungs, about not allowing them to have any damage. And so for us, it was things like... physiotherapy, chest physiotherapy every day, patting his chest when he was really little. And once he got a bit bigger, trying to encourage exercise, which we've done much, much more of as they've gotten bigger. And then they don't digest their food well, so it was enzymes. So he had to take little tiny pellets, sort of, with anything he ate, including breast milk, anything, so that he could digest his food and grow properly. And a lot of those things have become, in some ways, easier or at least normalized as they've gotten older. But when he was a brand new baby, it was just. I was a wreck. It was so much responsibility and so much to think about it and so many worries. I think I had no idea before having a child, maybe that this happens to everybody, and particularly having a child with illness, I had no idea there was sort of so much to fear in the world until that 6 months. Suddenly it really changed.
That's so interesting. You and your husband were big adventurers. You'd met being adventurers in many ways, and you'd ended up in New Zealand, and but then you're off again. France. Yes. Daryl got a job with the OECD, but along the way, you get pregnant again. Mm. Your second pregnancy, and this is a tough story to talk about, and we won't focus on it. But you did take a decision with that pregnancy, didn't you?
We did. So Aiden wasn't even a year old yet, and it was a bit ironic because we had so much trouble getting pregnant, and suddenly we were pregnant again. And we made the decision to test, and because you could test at the time early on in the pregnancy, and we found out that the baby had CF. And we took a really tough, what was for us anyway, a very, very tough decision, which was to terminate the pregnancy. And it felt still at that stage such an unknown. And if we weren't confident that we could, we weren't even confident we could give Aiden the life that we felt we needed to give to a child, a healthy life, a life. And it's all about, I suppose, to some extent, how you define what is a life that is, that is not worth living, but is not so traumatized. And I guess as young parents, we just didn't know. There was a lot of uncertainty for us.
And the reality is, with cystic fibrosis, people often don't make it to their 20s, their 30s, and very, very rarely to their 40s and 50s. So it's a life truncating illness that's
a tough road.
Involves a lot of invasive therapy. It's a massive thing. The response, though, from your very close church community to that decision that you took was a tough response, wasn't it?
It was a tough response, and I suppose we were, naive in thinking that people would really join with us in our pain and our uncertainty and our struggle through that decision, and it didn't really work out that way. And so that was really, really challenging time for us, I suppose me particularly, about how to move forward with that decision and move forward with our lives, because we still had a child to care for, and we still had a life which would become even more complicated in some ways, but we needed to keep moving forward and not get caught up in other people's judgment, but to say, well, that is what it is and we have to keep living.
It's tough, isn't it? And that's a very moving part of your book, that to read of the judgment that you received. Other people transcended that and embraced you in the decision that you'd taken. This is as much a story about medical systems, but being globetrotters, holidays inevitably became hospital visits as well along the way.
Yes.
And Paris was intriguing, wasn't it? And you actually, Paris is also where you got pregnant a third time.
Yes, that's right.
And this time you took a different decision.
We did. So our third pregnancy was with our son, Oliver, and we also tested and found out that he had CF as well, had cystic fibrosis, and we struggled. None of these decisions have been straightforward, I would say.
No.
And I think none of life's tough decisions ever are. But
And it's a recessive condition. So the one gene comes from you, one gene comes from your husband, and that's... at any point did you think, no more children?
Well, I think when we got to the decision about at this stage, we felt if we looked at it, we thought, well, we'd rather have a child with cystic fibrosis than not have another child. Mm-hmm. And we'd rather have another one who had cystic fibrosis, because we knew that how much we felt a lot more confident about our ability to manage Aiden's illness and to give him a good life. And we loved him, mm-hmm. and we loved being parents, and we felt we could manage it. And we felt that the weight of it would be on us. We weren't sort of putting some weight on someone else. We felt we could give him a really good life, and Oliver's having a fantastic life.
And an adventurous life too. Yeah. There's no constraints on these kids by the sounds. Mm. But this time, the reaction of the medical fraternity in France was an intriguing one, wasn't it?
I know, we just can't pick them, it seems. So yes, when we decided to go ahead with this, I mean, we really were considered complete dimwits for taking such a decision, and really short-sighted, and we must not understand the difficulty and the complexity of the condition. And it was as though we hadn't even Googled it, or much less lived with it for 3 years at that point. And so we again just had to say, well, some people will always judge you, and some people will support you, and we need to focus on those, you know, the decision we've made and the life that we're going to try to give to our kids and to ourselves and make the best of it. I think in many ways that's what life has been about for us, is saying, well, it really wasn't what I planned. It really isn't what I expected.
But, a major change in travel plans, I think, is another mother described a similar situation that really connected with you.
That was a wonderful story that someone that I'd read when Aiden was first diagnosed, about a woman who thought her whole life that she was going to go to, she tells this metaphor about her whole life, she thought she was going to go to Italy, and everybody wants to go to Italy, and they want to, you know, see the amazing, see Rome and enjoy the architecture and the food. And when she got off the plane, she discovered she was in Holland. And while there's nothing wrong with Holland, nobody sort of, it doesn't have that same kind of romance, and people don't think, oh, I can't wait to go to Holland. And so suddenly she was in Holland, and she was living, in her case, with a different chronic illness with her child. And that was what I think pregnancy for many women is, this expectation of going to Italy. And if you get there and it's not what you expected, how do you find joy in Holland? And I think for me, that was what I needed to do. I couldn't change the situation, so it was a choice of either being miserable in Holland or actually looking at the windmills and the tulips and I've been to Holland and I actually love it, in the North Sea, which is so dramatic. And so finding that your life was going to be different from the one you expected, and maybe different from the one that many other people live. But how do you find contentment in that some way, or...
Yes, contentment, the great quest. Susan Bigger is my guest this morning on Life Matters. She's written a memoir, The Upside of Down. And so far we've met two of her sons, Aiden and Oliver, both have cystic fibrosis. It's a tough diagnosis to live with. And we should just go a bit light on the French, because in fact their system was very receptive and responsive in terms of your needs as parents of children with CF, I get the impression.
Absolutely, and very very generous in its support. And we had a physiotherapist, Jean-Pierre, came to our house every day, and there were a lot of things that
invited you to dinner.
He did, that's right. And I think that's what we've learned about different medical systems. And coming here, where we came 12 years ago, you always realize that there are things that are a bit different and maybe you don't like as much, and things that you love. I would say one of the reasons we've stayed in Australia and will stay in Australia is because of the health system, which we love and which we really believe is giving our kids a good life and the best chance at life.
Not without its flaws.
No, not without its flaws. That's right. And I think that when we came here, one of the changes for me was as I reflected on what our experience had been in France, I started to see that that what mattered for families, not just my family, but other families I spoke to, not just other families with cystic fibrosis, but families with other conditions, was not just the outcomes, so the quality of care on a in terms of hygiene and safety and those kind of things, which are very, very important for families, but also about the experience of care. And I started realizing that it was the experience of the care in France that we found at times so difficult. The way that rules seemed arbitrary, or that siblings couldn't visit the ward, or that we weren't encouraged to stay with Oliver overnight, or those things that actually have a big impact.
And the doctors were very much the experts.
Absolutely. It wasn't a partnership in that sense. And I began to, Daryl and I both knew all along that we thought we would think, well, we're the ones that know our child best. We don't have a medical degree and we're not even going to try there. But we do know our child best. And we also know cystic fibrosis now after living with it for 18 years. We know it pretty well. And we know what works for our kids and what hasn't worked so well. So we really should be a part of that. And I think that's what patient-centered care is about, thinking about how do we include people as partners and really value the knowledge and experience that they bring, which families do bring so much, and patients about themselves, all that they know.
It's no coincidence, Susan, that you are one of the directors of the Australian Institute for Patient and Family-Centered Care now.
Yes, I'm very passionate about it. Yeah.
I wonder how the boys have talked about their mortality to you, given that they know, as well as anyone, that this will mean a truncated life for them.
Well, I think that they, I think we probably have taken it a little bit differently in the sense that I think we've said, well, here's statistically speaking, yes, this is where people often end up. So what we need to do is to somehow kind of constantly stay ahead of that curve. So how do we stay well and keep our lungs well and know that, for instance, there are breakthroughs happening all the time and that there's probably a cure possibly around the corner, around any corner, but hopefully we're very relatively optimistic about that. And so constantly saying, okay, well, if I keep my lungs well for 5 more years and 10 more years, and now I think at they're 18 and 16 and they're their lungs are good. They're great. And one of the ways they keep them really strong is that they have a really significant commitment to exercise and running. And so I have this image almost of they're sort of running to stay ahead of it and to say, I have to keep myself well. I have to keep my lungs clear. And also live my life today and enjoy it. So I think they're very content in their life. I think they are very optimistic. Maybe we're in my family too optimistic, but I think we actually believe that they have many, many years ahead of them, decades ahead.
Well,
of
more
them.
Than that, the trip to Machu Picchu, hiking the Inca Trail, the Make-A-Wish yes. Foundation granted that wish to Oliver. Yeah. So you are very determined not to contain these, well, now adolescent kids.
Young men, yes.
Young men, 18, absolutely. 16.
Yeah, if anything, we need to do the opposite. I think we need to really allow them to reach their goals and to just say, well, why not? Who says you can't? Oliver had always been interested in architecture and archaeology, and he loved the idea of hiking the Inca Trail. Well, why not? You know, who says you can't go to 4,500 meters? And
with compromised
lungs.
And in fact,
Daryl and I were the ones that were struggling more than the kids. And our third son, Ellis, who doesn't have CF, who was 8 at the time, I think there weren't many other 8-year-olds on the trail, but he rises to the challenge because he sees his brothers doing it and because it's just about, you know, what he's grown up with, which is just to take on what you have to take on.
Well,
I think.
Congratulations. All the very best for continuing adventures. Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters this morning.
Thank you. It's been good to be here.
Yes, Susan Bigger, the book, the memoir, is The Upside of Down. She's also one of the directors of the Australian Institute for Patient and Family-Centered Care. And the memoir is published by Transit Lounge, but we'll put the details on the Life Matters website. And rounding off the show, that's pretty much where we have to leave you, but stay with RN because Michael Cathcart is swinging your way straight after the news. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. It's NaNoWriMo.
What's that? I'm intrigued, Nano.
Yesterday I didn't know, today I do. NaNoWriMo is novel writing month. We're all writing novels.
Yes.
Well, I'm not, but across Australia there are people who are writing novels and you've got a month to do it.
Right. This is a bit like the Quick and Dirty Mills and Boone.
I think it's a good idea. Everyone thinks they've got a book in them. So this is the month to do it. And listen to this.
Is that an instrument?
That's a musical instrument. It's a completely mad musical instrument. There's an exhibition of these incredibly strange musical instruments that have been made by Indonesian instrument makers and Australian instrument makers. And we're going to have...
Are they made-up instruments or real instruments?
Completely. Well, they're real in the sense they make a noise, Ooh. But they're a bit silly.
We await. Straight after the news. Thanks, Michael. That's 10 a.m. Coming up to 10 a.m. But Books and Arts Daily straight after the news.
Now is an All in the Mind podcast, the powerful connection between the mind, the body and our health.
This is a paradigm whose time has come. People can be empowered to use their own healing resources.
They've just discovered that meditation can flip the switch on genes that affect disease.
Remarkable stories of recovery on All in the Mind with me, Lynn Malcolm. You can download this All in the Mind from the RN website.